Today at Reader's Corner, we welcome Candace Taylor, author of Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Overground Railroad by Candace Taylor explores the historical role and residual impact of The Green Book, a travel guide for Black motorists. Deeply researched through extensive travel and photography, Overground Railroad is an account of the Green Book's important role during the years that Jim Crow laws were in place across much of America. Published from 1936 to 1966, the Green Book was a resourceful and innovative solution to a horrific problem. Overground Railroad celebrates the stories of those who put their names in the book and stood up against racism, as it shows how we arrived at our present historical moment and how far we still have to go when it comes to race relations in America. Candace Taylor is an award-winning author, photographer, cultural documentarian. Her work has been featured in over 50 media outlets, including The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and the CBS Morning Show. She is a recipient of numerous fellowships and grants, including the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard University and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Candace Taylor, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. This is a real honor. I've just so much enjoyed your book. And I have to ask you, first of all, though, when you were working on your book, was that about the same time, like 2 years ago, that the movie Green Book about Don Shirley touring the South with his white driver came out?
I started working on this book in 2013. So,
yeah, right.
So it was way before the film came out.
Right.
I was on the road for almost 2 years. I was living in Los Angeles when I started the project. And during that time from LA, I moved almost 8 times doing this research, this field research, doing the fellowships. So I was kind of on the road. My things were in storage. So I think I was settled in Denver when the film came out, and actually Universal Studios interviewed me to put me on the DVD of the film, because the biggest question when they were doing the screen test, the one question that everybody asked was, what was the Green Book about? Because the film was essentially not about the Green Book.
Right.
So I was there to give that kind of historical background information.
I think there was only that one moment in the film when Viggo Mortensen is talking to his wife, I guess, and he has a copy of the Green Book and he's trying to explain it to her, and that's it. I don't think you ever again hear about the Green Book, but I would assume that just the title of the Green Book and the movie being out was a little bit of a lift for you. If you're sitting there in 2018 toward the end of this project, wondering whether anybody's going to understand what the Green Book is, well, the movie may have given you a bit of an assist there.
Yeah, it was a double-edged sword, honestly. In some ways it did, and it gave it name recognition, it became more of a household name, but it was a missed and lost opportunity because it wasn't an accurate representation of the Green Book. It really misrepresented the Green Book in some fundamental ways. So content-wise, it was really a missed opportunity for them to tell the story. And then it makes it harder for us as, you know, Black folks to tell our story. Because now when we go to Hollywood, I mean, I'm in very early discussions about making my book into a television series. The one thing the managers who were talking about shopping this around is that they say it's going to be harder to sell because people are going to say, oh, there was already something about that. So I think the Green Book, in terms of its history, in terms of what it is and who it served and how powerful it was, and there's still so many stories we don't know about the Green Book. I mean, I think essentially once you just tell people what that was and you can see them, they've digitized the Green Books, the Schomburg Library in Harlem digitized the Green Books online so you can actually flip through them and you see how rich and interesting they are. It's not a huge, you know, it's not hard to sell that as an idea because it is so interesting. So,
right.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword.
So let's talk about your book, and I want our listeners to understand this isn't the typical narrative alone that we usually discuss at Reader's Corner. Your book is almost a multimedia presentation. Maybe you could help our listeners understand what's in it besides the text and besides the messaging. You've got some fascinating things in this book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the book was really, you know, I got my master's degree in visual criticism at California College of the Arts. I've been an artist all my life. And visual criticism is essentially taking really complex ideas, assessing them, and basically giving them a platform that they're easy to consume. So that was really key. It's grounded in scholarly research, but it is not an academic book. And it was very important to me from the beginning that it not be an academic book. You know, this book was built for a general audience, a mass audience. When I signed with Abrams, my publisher, and they've been wonderful, I was even worried with Abrams because they make such beautiful books. They make these beautiful art books. And I didn't want it to be too pretty or too nice or too art focused because then people would think it's not a serious book. So right. It was a challenge to really have that middle ground of something that's engaging, that's interesting to look at, that's new because there's over 150 photographs, and they are all of different eras. There's archival historical photographs. There's my photographs that I've taken of these buildings, of these Green Book sites. They're treated in specific ways, so they look almost a little ethereal or a little otherworldly, but still very direct, and they don't look treated. You know, there was a lot of energy on my end to make them, to make it not just look like you took a picture of a building outside, but to also give it some layers of history. And then there were these brightly colored, you know, linen photographs, and they're almost technicolor. So there was a lot of discussion and concern on my part, like, how do we put all these different images, these types of images, the history behind these images, and make them cohesively feel like they belong in the same book, was always a concern. There's four different narrative structures going on. There's Ron, my stepfather's stories. There's my stories. There's the story of, you know, history. And then there's a contemporary references of race and social mobility for Black people. So all of those different narrative layers were difficult to do. And to be honest, by the end, when I was finished, I was so exhausted because I only had 8 months to write the book. Even though I've been working on it and doing all this research, I really only had 8 months to write the book, and I was so exhausted. But when I turned it in, I just thought, I don't even know if this makes sense. I have no idea what I'm going to end up with. I was glad that it was done, but I just said, I hope people like it and that it makes sense. That was my
It makes lots of sense. I have to say that, I so much enjoyed it for many of the reasons you've just cited. And I want to jump right into Ron, your stepfather. I found the credit that you gave to your stepfather, Ron, to be such a tribute to a man who lived through Jim Crow in his earlier years and then went on to distinguish himself in corrections administration in Ohio. And what I'd like to do is just touch on three different lessons, let's call them, that you picked up from him. As I remember in your book, he didn't talk about these things early in life, but you eventually got it out of him. So let's just start with number one, the chauffeur's hat and Ron as a child in the back seat of his parents' car getting pulled over by the law. This may be one good example of why somebody like Victor Green would write the Green Book. Please tell us that story.
Yeah, Ron was my stepfather. I had known him most of my life since I was about 13. And we were never really close. I mean, we got along and we liked each other. And, you know, he was part of the family, of course. And I loved him, you know, because I'd known him most of my life. But he was a big Marine, lots of testosterone. And I just didn't get him. I didn't understand. You know, I felt like he was a little paranoid about things. And so we just were never really close. But then when I started working this material, and I really understood, you know, Memphis. He was from Memphis, Tennessee. And I started understanding the South in a different way. I think he saw commonality in terms of what I was doing and the things that I was learning, he was really interested in. And so we had more discussions. And you know, I'd go home for Christmas every year. And one year I was, I kept reading about the chauffeur's hat in different literature, that black men would use a chauffeur's hat as a ruse. So they would, it would explain, especially if they had a nicer car, it would explain why they had this car, because they would lie and say they were a chauffeur and that it wasn't their car. And that was something that the police could accept. And I kept reading that black men did this during Jim Crow. And so I asked Ron just casually in the kitchen one day, I said, you know, do you know anything? Have you heard of this? Is this true? Because you read things, you don't know, you know, really can't believe everything you read. And he said, oh yeah. He was like, you know, and he, this story just tumbles out of his mouth that I had never heard before. He basically said at the age of 7, when he was with his parents, his father had a good job with the railroad and they had a nice new car, and they were driving north across the Tennessee border on a short vacation, and they get pulled over. And right when they get pulled over, you know, it's his mother and his father in the front seat and Ron was in the back seat. And as soon as they get pulled over, Ron's father turns to him and literally just, you know, with this look in his eyes and says, do not say a word. And Ron had never heard his father talk to him in that tone. And he just, you know, he was taken aback by that. And so the sheriff comes to the side of the car and says, first thing he asks, he says, whose car is this? Where are you going? And who are these people with you? And Ron's father, he looks at his wife and he pretends not to know her and says, well, I'm a chauffeur and this is my employer's car. She's the maid. He points to his wife. And that's her son. And I'm driving them home. And so the officer says, you know, well, where's your hat? And he says, it's hanging right in the back, officer. And there was a black chauffeur's hat hanging in the back seat. And Ron said he always saw that hat there. He never knew what it was. He'd never seen anybody wear it. He never understood what it was or why it was there. And he said after that happened, nearly every other black man's car he rode in had one. And it was this kind of universal tool, you know, of survival. For Jim Crow. Right.
You're listening to Candace Taylor. She's the author of Overground Railroad, The Green Book, and The Roots of Black Travel in America. And you also, you didn't understand why you took so many vacation trips or driving trips at night.
Yeah, that would drive me crazy. That was another reason why Ron, I just didn't get him. I didn't understand. And I wasn't even on most of these trips. I was more concerned about my mother, who was with him. And I said, why would you put your life at risk, everybody else's life at risk on the road, and more importantly, my mother's life at risk, basically so you can drive in the middle of the night? Because I would say, you know, why? He'd leave at like 10 at night to drive, you know, to Memphis. And it was, I don't know, 9 or 10 hours or something. It's like, why are you driving all night? And he would just say traffic. He wouldn't go into any elaborate, just one word, traffic. I was like, that makes no sense. It just didn't make any sense to me. And until I started writing this book and I realized how important it was for him to be invisible and how, and he was in law enforcement. That's the irony of it. If Ron ends up being in law enforcement, you know, he was in correctional facilities and he would never state that, you know, this, you know, we didn't talk about race and the police department very much. And I know he really valued his position. There were only 5 people in the state above him in the correctional system. He still knew very much how it worked in the real world. And him as a dark-skinned black man driving during the day was just more hassle than he wanted to deal with. And there were too many variables, too many things that could go wrong. So he figured, you know, driving at night makes it just so much easier. And now I understand why he did that.
We're talking thus far about what appears to be leisure travel, where an African-American family gets in a car and decides to take a short vacation. I think you touched in your book about another need for travel and another need, therefore, for the Green Book. And that's a different kind of travel, a migration, so to speak, from the South to the North.
Yeah, the Green Book was, it was an incredible guide because it didn't just serve middle-class black people, people who could afford to take a vacation. It was also a wonderful tool for those who were fleeing racial terror in the South. And The Green Book was in publication during the second wave of the Great Migration. From the 40s to the late 60s, early 70s was that second wave of the Great Migration. And about 1.5 million people were leaving the South. Ultimately, I think close to over 6 million people left the South. But there were these things called tourist sites in the Green Book, which were essentially kind of, you consider them maybe the first Airbnbs. They were largely run by women. Many were widowed women who had houses with extra bedrooms, and they would have an extra bed for someone to sleep in. And they were generally very, very inexpensive, and you could get a warm meal. And they were really a great tool for those who were migrating and didn't have the funds to get service on the way to their destination.
So let's talk about the creator of the Green Book. Who was Victor Green? And you might want to share with our listeners his own personal experience that really led him to the idea of the Green Book.
Yeah, Victor Green was the man who created the Green Book. He was a postal worker from Harlem. He had a seventh grade education. The first Green Book was published in 1936. This was a year after in Harlem, there was a huge race riot in Harlem. So the context of him creating this guide, I mean, he really created it just for Harlem, because he thought, well, even though we think of Harlem as this mecca for Black entertainment and arts and culture, it really was still very segregated, even in the 30s. This is after the Renaissance, the 1920s Black Renaissance. So half the places along 125th Street still didn't serve Black folks. So he was really solving a problem within his own community of Harlem. And that first Green Book really just did have Harlem Green Book sites of locals. So by 1937, that's the first edition that we have access to, really. There are some places in Westchester County that are north of the city. And we think that part of the reason why we don't know, honestly, what Victor Green was thinking exactly, but there were some things that point to probably what led him to create the Green Book. And one of those things is he had a friend who was Jewish, who used a guide, kosher guide, to help him when he traveled the Borscht Belt, which was a very popular tourist area attraction north of the city. He would take his guide with him. And Victor Green thought, well, that's really convenient. And that would make a lot of sense for us. Because as Black folks, he was driving his wife, Alma Duke Green, who was an incredible ally in, I think, the creation and also the longevity of the Green Book. And she rarely gets credit. I have a chapter in my book just dedicated to women in the Green Book. She's a very critical part, I think, in this story. But Victor's driving Alma to Richmond pretty regularly, Richmond, Virginia, because that was where she was from. And so, of course, that was another example of where he knew that things were not, you know, it wasn't so easy to find a place to eat and a place to sleep. So the Green Book very quickly grew from just this, you know, guide that focused on Harlem and New York. And within a couple of years, it was in every state east of the Mississippi River. And then it grew throughout the country, and then it became international in the later editions.
I guess for us smug Northerners, we would probably draw the conclusion that most of this problem was a Southern problem. And yet in your book, you talk about these sundown towns that didn't seem to respect the Mason-Dixon line.
No. And I'm tired of the North getting away with being the good guys right here, because, you know, essentially America is America. And Jim Crow knew no borders. And people, especially who were fleeing racial terror in the South during the Great Migration, learned very quickly that although there may not have been as many signs of colored and white, there were sundown towns. And there could be a whole sign at the county line saying, "Inward, don't let the sun set on you here." So you were not allowed in that town after 6 p.m. if you were Black. And if you were found there, there could be severe consequences. And these were largely a Northern, Midwestern, and Western phenomena. You know, for an example, the state of Illinois had over 400 sundown towns, and the state of Mississippi had 13. So there were definitely rules. I mean, there was definitely hard segregation. There, you know, I don't want to let the South off either. The rules have been so established and entrenched in that history of slavery and all of the different generations of Black folks really had a good sense of where they could be and where they couldn't be. And if you were mistaken, there were signs. But this idea that the North was, and even the West, was different or had this mecca of, you know, acceptability and desegregate was not, it just wasn't the case. If segregation laws weren't written in the books, there were social mores and social structures that were in place. The beaches were still segregated in California. The pools were segregated. Black folks couldn't swim except on the last day before they cleaned the pool each week in places like Pasadena. And what I think the thing that was even more interesting to me learning when I was reading the testimonies and stories about people traveling, Black people traveling west and up north, it became even more dangerous in some ways because at least in the South, you did have enough information as to where you could and couldn't be. Where in the North, you could easily find yourself in the wrong place and then it would be too late. So for instance, if you were driving Route 66 from Chicago to LA, half the counties along Route 66 were sundown towns, but you wouldn't know that ahead of time. They didn't have sundown town maps. They didn't have the internet. They didn't have that information. So if you're driving and it happens to be dark after 6 p.m., and every town you get to is a sundown town sign. And how do you get around it? What do you do? What decisions do you have to make? And it's late and maybe you haven't eaten in a while. I mean, it was very serious. So traveling in the rest of the country was a challenge, to say the least.
Candace, I think I read that most of the businesses in the Green Book, the safe and accommodating places for African-Americans to stop and get a service of some kind, whether it was food, whether it was lodging, were Black-owned. Is that correct? Was that the majority?
The majority were. There's no way to know definitively because I've cataloged nearly 10,000 of these Green Book sites that were listed in the Green Book from the 30s to the 60s. And I'm still honestly doing that research. And it's, you know, tracking down owners and proprietor, it's a challenge, but it's fun and it's part of the research. Yeah. But I found that, yeah, if I had to estimate and guess, I would say about 80-85% were Black owned.
I guess there's really no way to know this, but for the rest of those white owners, sure seems to me like they were taking some very serious risks. I guess I can understand a Black lodging where they would be accepted. And since the town is segregated anyway, whites might not even know that Blacks were moving in to a town on a given night to eat and stay over and then take off again. But boy, a white-owned establishment taking in an African-American family could be a rather serious issue, I would think.
Yeah, it depended on that white ally and how they, I guess, had presented themselves in that community. In some ways, we see in the Green Books, really, there were such a variety of different businesses that, you know, were listed in the Green Book. And it wasn't just, and that's part of what the problem I had with the film was that it kind of presented that the only options for Dr. Shirley were these kind of downtrodden places. And that really was not, especially even in the 60s, mm-hmm. that was not the case. Because if you could afford it, the Waldorf Astoria was listed in the Green Book. The Drake Hotel in Chicago is in the Green Book. The Bel Air Hotel in Los Angeles was in the Green Book. I mean, these very famous, very fabulous places were in the Green Book that were white owned, if you could afford it. But the other reality of when they came, you know, by the 60s, it was safer for white owners to do that because you've got to, you know, remember 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education happens. So even those who want to hold on to, you know, staunch segregationists are realizing that that way of life is being threatened, that integration is happening because they were forcing it through the Supreme Court in the schools. So they could see the writing on the wall. So those white-owned businesses that already were on the right side of history and thought, you know, I really would like to have more Black people because it was just also more money. It makes better business sense to have more people come to you know, basically support your business. regardless of race. So it was a win-win for those white-owned, white operators that weren't racist. But they knew that because the country was racist in so many ways, there were a lot of racists maybe that were coming to their community, or people who believed that if they saw a black person, it would somehow bring down the stature of this, you know, of this place. So they had to be very conscious of, yeah, when they did accept black people, who were those, their regular people that they had been serving for years, sometimes generations, would they lose those customers? And in several places in the book, you know, I show where that struggle happened. But when you read stories like Charlie's Sandwich Shop on the south side of Boston, it was very staunch in a white, notorious community for not accepting black folks. The way that he handled it, the operator was really, he had a lot of courage. And, you know, and I think we need to celebrate those people who did stand behind us and made sure that we were a part of that story, because most business owners didn't have the courage to do that. But then it became easier by the 60s because a lot more businesses were doing it and it wasn't such a bold move.
So I have time for one more question. You managed to travel around 4,000 miles, I think you said in the book, in order to learn about these places, to take photos about these places and put them in historical perspective. Mm-hmm. You do provide at the end of your book a Green Book site tour. And I wonder if you could just comment on that. It might be a nice way to leave off here when we all can not only read the book, but we might, depending on where these are, visit some of them.
Yeah, I think it's important that we realize that this history, you know, these Green Book sites, the actual businesses that are still operating, I've estimated that less than 3%, well, really between 3 and 5%, depending on this. Certain cities like Los Angeles has a lot more standing than other places. But the fact that that we have these buildings and sometimes a business actually still there, it's tangible evidence of this history. And I think it's important to go to some of these communities and really see, you know, some of the architecture is beautiful. The fact that any business is still around even 10 years after it opens is a miracle. You know, so mm-hmm. The fact that some of these businesses have been in operation for 80 plus years and some of them are black owned. I mean, that's incredible. It's an incredible reason to celebrate. So yeah, I would encourage everyone to look in the back of the book and see, you know, what it's not a complete list of all the Green Book sites, but I am developing a mobile app. And I did get a grant from National Geographic to develop a digital interactive map of these Green Book sites, and also tracking other narratives of racial, social, and physical mobility. So it also maps the sundown towns. Maybe you were raised in a sundown town, didn't know it. It also shows how many private prisons are in that community today. So the book ends with this site tour, but the work I'm doing now really builds on that and gives people an ability to even go into their neighborhoods and see maybe there's environmental racism happening, you know, in your community with higher lead levels, educational disparities, health disparities. There's all these socioeconomic data sets that really do explain why we still have so far to go. And I don't even have to do that in my work because we see it now in the news. When you look at COVID and you see people are saying, oh, well, why is it that black people are dying at 2 and 3 times the rate? This is the material. These are the data sets that really help us explain how this has happened. And hopefully my book, reading the book, will also show you why there's so many layers to resolving this problem, why changing chokehold laws in the streets isn't going to solve the problem. There are so many systemic issues that we really have to address and deal with head on and understand before we really can become a part of the solution. So, and hopefully, you know, the goal of me writing this book was to at least give people the historical understanding and knowledge so that when now you look at the world, you hopefully see it a little differently. It's a little more complicated. But as you said at the beginning, I didn't want to make the book complicated or difficult to understand.
Well, we scheduled this, and I found this book before George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis and before the Black Lives Matter movement was re-energized. But when I realized that these two events were coming together, it made perfect sense for me to get this on Reader's Corner as soon as we could. And again, we look forward. Candace Taylor, I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. And the name of your book, once again, Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was perfect timing, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.